Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media in election mode means lots of talk about strategy and tactics and who candidates would like to have a beer with. What it could use more of is attention to core electoral issues like who gets to vote. Joining us to discuss the first presidential race in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act is Ari Berman, senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and author of the new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Also on the show, The New York Times has just run an eye-opening series on just what you sign away in those fine print contracts, now necessary for everything from buying a cell phone to getting a job, namely your right to justice in a court of law. We'll talk about forced arbitration and what it means with Joanne Dorashow, founder and executive director of the Center for Justice and Democracy. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. Most obituaries of former Iraqi dissident and discredited huckster Ahmed Chalabi, who died November 2nd, were straightforward. But as Adam Johnson notes on Fair.org, a disconcerting number of outlets took a weird turn, portraying Chalabi as responsible for the U.S. war on Iraq. Iraqi architect of U.S. invasion is dead, was the headline in the Daily Beast, which claimed Chalabi was, quote, most remembered for his role in convincing the United States to invade his country, close quote. The New York Times had it that he, quote, helped persuade the United States to invade Iraq in 2003, close quote. And pundit and Council on Foreign Relations fellow Max Boot claimed Chalabi manipulated the U.S. into war. To be persuaded or manipulated, though, one has to have previously been skeptical or unwilling, and those words just don't apply here. As Paul Waldman reminded in The Week, in the summer of 2002, the White House already had what former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan called a script for a, quote, campaign to convince Americans that war with Iraq was inevitable and necessary, close quote. Those paying attention know that intelligence on Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction wasn't mistaken, as we commonly hear today. It was, like most intelligence, a mass of contradictions and differing interpretations, from which the administration cherry-picked the parts they wanted to serve that campaign. George W. Bush's own Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, told 60 Minutes in 2004 that Bush, quote, sought a way to invade Iraq, close quote. Emails show Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair planning the war a year before 9/11. Put simply, the Bush administration didn't need convincing. What it needed was fodder to convince the American public, not all of whom, of course, were ever convinced. And Chalabi and his claims served that function. Of course, as U.S. corporate media were active participants in this disastrous deception, they have every incentive to remember it differently. When you see a piece in elite U.S. media headlined, Why Denmark Isn't the Utopian Fantasy Bernie Sanders Describes, you probably have a sense of what you're in for. And the Washington Post November 3rd article delivers with a piece centered on an interview with a British journalist who's written a book that purports to go behind the myth of the Scandinavian utopia. Naturally, proving a place is not utopia is easy work. Michael Booth tells us that the weather in the Nordic countries is appalling, the languages impenetrable, and the food awful. But presumably linking the piece to the U.S. election means we're actually supposed to take it seriously. So it does matter that, as Dean Baker notes on Fair.org, the article's pronouncements about Scandinavian societies contain actual misinformation. For example, the Post's interviewer, Anna Swanson, points to a lower proportion of people working as a worrying sign for Denmark's economy and its model. Denmark's employment rate has been declining, but it's still far higher than the United States. If the rate of decline since the 2001 peak continues, it will fall below the current U.S. level in roughly 24 years. And when Booth says that, though it's true that Scandinavian countries are the most gender-equal societies in the world, they also record the highest rates of violence towards women, it seems worth noting that Danish women are far less likely to be murdered by their husbands or boyfriends than women in the U.S., a rate of 0.8 per 100,000 compared to 4.7 per 100,000 here. What about relative income equality, free universities, parental leave, subsidized childcare, and a national health system? That just sounds good, Post readers are told. But really, quote, in Denmark, the quality of the free education and healthcare is substandard. They are way down on the PISA, Program for International Student Assessment, educational rankings, have the lowest life expectancy in the region and the highest rates of death from cancer. And there is broad consensus that the economic model of a public sector and welfare state on this scale is unsustainable, close quote. You won't be shocked to hear that on both those educational rankings and life expectancy, Denmark is well ahead of the U.S. And there's no evidence presented or requested that that broad consensus exists anywhere outside of Booth's head. So by the time you get to the claim that information on Denmark's public spending, quote, is kept deliberately opaque by the authorities, close quote, though Baker was able to find it quickly on the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's website, you've got the point. The Post doesn't want you getting any silly ideas about looking elsewhere for economic or social models. And if conveying that requires misinforming, well, so be it. And finally, also on the Washington Post, the paper's November 3rd article on the car app Uber is, not to put too fine a point on it, a puff piece. Company VP and spokesperson David Plouffe is permitted to say without challenge things like, quote, Uber can quite literally help transport people out of poverty, offering people affordable rides whenever, wherever they need one, close quote. And to allege, laughably enough, that criticism of the company's practices has flourished, quote, because we haven't gone out there in a full-throated way and engaged in these debates, close quote. As an advertisement for a controversial company, it's got it all. As journalism, it could have used minimally one more thing, a disclosure that Post owner Jeff Bezos is a major Uber investor. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Whether Donald Trump will be permitted to determine the format, content, and room temperature of future GOP debates is a worthy topic for media discussion, but there are other, more baseline electoral issues that call for media attention, like whether everyone eligible to vote will be able to. The 2016 election will be the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. Joining us now to discuss the significance of that is Ari Berman. He's a senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's author of, most recently, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Welcome to Counterspin, Ari Berman.
Thanks, Janine.
Well, listeners will have heard about Alabama, which passed a law saying you need photo ID to vote and then closed 31 departments of motor vehicles where many get such ID. The DMVs were closed in 8 of the 10 counties with the highest concentrations of black voters. It certainly sounds like a disproportionate impact, and it suggests why you can title your book The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. What's the lesson from Alabama in particular, and isn't some law being contravened there?
Well, I think the lesson in Alabama is that the struggle over voting rights was not settled in 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And my book, Give Us the Ballot, looks at the 50 years that came after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, because many people know that there was this triumphant march from Selma to Montgomery. They know that there was incredible violence inflicted on people like Congressman John Lewis, but they don't really know what occurred after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. I think it's critically important to emphasize that the struggle for voting rights did not end in 1965. And in fact, I started covering voting rights far more recently, after the 2010 election, when so many states passed new voting restrictions, doing things like shutting down voter registration drives, cutting back early voting, requiring strict voter ID to cast a ballot, purging the voting rolls, disenfranchising ex-felons. Half the states in the country passed new laws restricting the right to vote after the 2010 election. And it wasn't just occurring in Alabama and Georgia. It was also occurring in northern states, places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Ohio. So we're in a whole new struggle over the right to vote now.
And yet it seemed that the Voting Rights Act being outdated or no longer necessary, wasn't that part of the rationale for the Supreme Court's 2013, you call it a gutting of the VRA? That was part of what they were claiming, was it not?
It was. So what the Supreme Court did in the 2013 decision, Shelby County versus Holder, is they said that those states with the longest histories of voting discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government, that the formula under which those states were covered was unconstitutional, and that Congress would have to draw a new formula to update the law, or else you no longer had to approve your voting changes if you were a state like Alabama. The problem with that opinion is that it missed that voter suppression did not end in 1965, that this particular part of the law blocked 3,000 discriminatory voting changes from 1965 to 2013. And it blocked voting changes as recently as the 2012 election, when restrictive laws like Texas's voter ID law, where you can vote with a handgun permit but not a student ID, were blocked under the Voting Rights Act. And so I think the Supreme Court only wanted to talk about the progress that had been made since 1965, the election of the first black president, the election of black congressmen and mayors, and all down the line. And they ignored all the barriers that have still been erected in the decades since.
To be clear, would that Alabama move of shutting down those DMVs, would that have been something that they would have had to get approval for?
Yes, I think so. They either would have had to submit it for approval, and it certainly would have been blocked because, as you mentioned, 8 of 10 majority black counties had their DMV offices shut down. So there was clearly a disproportionate impact on African Americans. Or if they didn't approve it, they would have been sued by a civil rights group, and then they would have had to approve it anyway. So, I mean, either way, this is the very type of change affecting voting that the Department of Justice or the federal courts would have liked to look at. And what I show in my book is that there were decades of struggles in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s to get states like Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia and Louisiana to comply with the Voting Rights Act. These states kept thinking of new and ingenious ways to try to thwart the power of the act, and that's why the Voting Rights Act was so important.
Well, you suggest that while those interested, openly or not, in restricting the franchise have been very busy indeed, those interested in expanding it and allowing more people to vote haven't really matched that energy. But we do have the example of California to hold up alongside that of Alabama.
I do think that states are becoming more aggressive about trying to expand voting rights in response to other states that are trying to restrict voting rights. And the most ambitious reforms have occurred at first in Oregon and then in California. They are going to automatically register people who request a driver's license or an ID from the DMV, and then those voters can then opt out if they don't want to register. And that's going to add a lot of people to the voting rolls. In Oregon, the expectation is it'll add 300,000 people to the voting rolls. In California, it could add 6 million new voters to the voting rolls, which is an absolutely huge number, larger than you'd ever register during a voter registration drive. But beyond the fact that all these people are registering, I think it's important because it's a way of thinking about the vote as a right and not a privilege, which we've done for so many years, and saying that in a democracy, we're better off when more people participate, and it's the responsibility of the state, of the government, to get more people involved. And so what California and Oregon are doing is in very stark contrast to what places like Texas and Alabama are doing.
Well, what about on the federal level? There are moves, are there not, to restore those provisions to the VRA?
There is legislation in Congress to restore the Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Advancement Act of 2015. There is also bills for automatic voter registration on a national level that has been introduced, and bills that would make it so that you wouldn't have to wait a long time in line to vote. Unfortunately, none of these efforts are moving legislatively because Republicans in Congress just aren't very interested in it. And I think that basically, you know, if your party has decided that you're going to make it harder for people to vote, you're not going to be in favor of things like a Voting Rights Act.
Well, one person who said there's no role for the federal government here is Jeb Bush. I'll refer folks to your writing in The Nation, but briefly, he would have particular reasons for that stance, wouldn't he?
Well, I mean, it was sort of interesting to hear Jeb Bush say that certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act were no longer necessary when it was his very brother that signed the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 2006, a law that passed by a vote of 390-33 in the House and 98-0 in the Senate. And I'm fairly certain Jeb Bush would have been for that effort in 2006, and that was only 9 years ago. So I have a hard time believing the country has changed so dramatically in the last 9 years that a reauthorization that was warranted in 2006 is no longer needed in 2015. Also, when he was governor, there was a massive voter purge in Florida in the 2000 election. Thousands of people were wrongly labeled as felons. They were purged from the voting rolls. They were unable to vote in the 2000 election in Florida. The NAACP sued Florida, and they found that 12,000 people were wrongly labeled as felons and potentially prevented from voting. That was 22 times George W. Bush's margin of victory in the state. So this voter purge definitely played a role in the outcome of the 2000 election, and this all happened on Jeb Bush's watch in Florida. So I think if anyone should be supporting an expansion and protection of voting rights, it's Jeb Bush, given what happened on his watch.
Well, finally, it seems fair to say that you think that voting access is an issue that ought to be, that media ought to be asking candidates about as we go forward into this election.
It really should, and I think it's unfortunate that the media is not asking about these issues because they're focusing so much on personalities and poll numbers, but they're not focusing on the fundamental reality, which is that if people can't vote, then there's not a whole lot of point in even having an election. And so the first presidential debate, which occurred on Fox News, was on the actual 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. August 6th, 2015 was the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson signing the VRA, and the subject of voting rights never came up, and it hasn't come up in the subsequent three debates. I'm hopeful that it'll come up in the future, but I think candidates need to talk about these underlying issues that shape so much of the election: whether people can vote, how much money there is in the political system, who is restricting the right to vote, who is trying to buy these candidates. These are ultimately the issues that are going to decide the election far more than Hillary Clinton's emails or Donald Trump's hair.
We've been speaking with Ari Berman. The book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Thank you very much, Ari Berman, for joining us on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine.
Say you discover that your cell phone company has been taking money from you for roaming charges for calls you made from your home, or that your employer has been denying you payment for extra work you're required to do, or your mother's nursing home gives her too much medication and she dies. What power do you as an individual have compared to a big corporation except to take them to court? But then what if it turns out you can't? Why? Because you signed away your right to a jury trial in the fine print contract you had to agree to get that cell phone service, that job, that nursing home care. This is the alarming reality exposed in a recent New York Times series reported by Jessica Silver Greenberg, Michael Corkery, and Robert Gabeloff. Here to bring us more on the issue and what we can do about it is Joanne Doroshow, founder and executive director of the Center for Justice and Democracy and co-founder of Americans for Insurance Reform. She's also adjunct professor at New York Law School. Welcome back to Counterspin, Joanne Doroshow.
Great to be here.
Well, there are some distinctions to be made here. There's a difference between having arbitration as an option and forced arbitration, for one, and then what the Times is talking about is the increased use of contracts that both push consumers and employees to arbitration to settle disputes and ban them from participation in class action lawsuits. For those who haven't seen the Times' series, and I think we'd both recommend it, what's going on here? It seems deeply significant.
Yes, it is, and it's fairly recent. It's really the result of two major Supreme Court decisions, one in 2011 and one in 2013, that upheld companies' use of what we call forced arbitration clauses and class action bans. In other words, what we're seeing now with the support of the U.S. Supreme Court are companies inserting in fine print of technically contracts, but they're the kinds of things, for example, if you're purchasing something on the internet, you just will hit agree and you don't really read those long contracts that are there. You know, they're there, but nobody really reads them. And one of the clauses in these contracts now says basically if you have a dispute with the company, you no longer have your constitutional right to civil jury trial. You must resolve that dispute in a corporate designed arbitration system run by an arbitrator who may or may not even be a lawyer, who doesn't have to follow any rules of law. It's secret. There's basically no appeal. You're basically subject to the biases and the manipulations of the arbitrator and the company who hired that arbitrator. And as you also mentioned, the U.S. Supreme Court also upheld a part of the forced arbitration clause, which bans class actions. That means if you've been, let's say, cheated by your bank, and it's a relatively small amount of money, you're never going to be able to sue that bank in court. The only possible way you have of recovering the money you've been cheated out of is to join with others in a class action lawsuit. And it's the only way to get the company to really stop this behavior.
Well, if I can bring you back to that 2013 Supreme Court ruling, Scalia actually said, antitrust laws do not guarantee an affordable procedural path to the vindication of every claim. That seems monumental, but as I understand it, it really wasn't made much of at the time.
The court looked at, strangely enough, a 1925 law called the Federal Arbitration Act, which was passed at the time just to facilitate arbitration between businesses. It was never intended by Congress to be expanded to affect consumers and their disputes with big institutions. But the Supreme Court said, nonetheless, this 1925 law takes precedent over every other state and federal law on the books. And even though there should be a right to go to court to remedy discrimination, to remedy fraud and abuse, the court said, we don't care. If a company wants to force you to arbitrate, that's okay.
People think that when you talk about corporations getting together and making a decision to remove legal rights from consumers and employees, that sounds like conspiracy theory. But in a sense, that's really what happened.
Yeah, I mean, what we found out from this New York Times series is that in 1999, a bunch of big companies got together in a room and decided how they were going to start strategizing to make sure that they could start doing this to consumers, that they could start inserting these clauses and banning class actions, and that the U.S. Supreme Court would uphold it. It was really startling to find out that the current Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, when he was a corporate defense lawyer, was part of all of that. He was representing Discover, the credit card company at the time. And so now we're stuck with these decisions.
It seems important, again, to underscore that class action lawsuits, while they might be about the $30 overcharge that one person got, they really also are the only way in some way that you can expose wrongdoing on a big scale. I mean, some of these cases are about Taco Bell, for example, the charge that they, at least one outlet, was denying black people promotions. You know, the class action lawsuit isn't just about the particular legal remedies for individuals. They really are about exposing wrongdoing on a larger scale.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most famous class actions in history was Brown versus Board of Education. It is a very important tool for anyone who has been discriminated against or who wants to try to hold big institutions to account for any kind of wrongdoing.
Well, the pushback to the Time series is already underway. Forbes had a piece saying, aha, the Times doesn't tell you who the lawyer was for one of the businesses involved in a case against American Express. He's a lawyer known for fighting credit card companies. That's the real face of consumer class action. These aren't lawsuits by little guys trying to vindicate their rights. They're lawsuits by wealthy attorneys trying to get wealthier.
Yeah, well, that's the only thing they have to say, is try to blame lawyers. But there's nothing that I've seen so far in any of the critiques coming from business of these New York Times articles that suggests in any way that there is anything inaccurate about anything they said. What these businesses try to do is make it seem as if consumers are not benefiting from these class actions. But what we also know is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in March, after a long empirical study, they found in just like the last year, tens of millions of people benefiting to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars.
And the Time series actually cites it's not just lawyers. They also have law enforcement and judges saying, you know, we've lost a critical tool here. Hopefully this Time series is shining a light on something, but what can we do about it and what is being done about it?
There is a bill in Congress called the Arbitration Fairness Act. It is being spearheaded and pushed very hard right now in the Senate by Senator Franken, Senator Leahy, and there's a companion bill in the House by Congressman Johnson. People should let their members of Congress and senators know that they support the Arbitration Fairness Act. The other important thing to remember is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is about to issue a rule. While they wouldn't ban forced arbitration clauses, they would prohibit companies from putting class action bans in these arbitration clauses. So this is a very important development, and this agency needs a lot of support also from the public because there's enormous pushback coming from big business on this proposed rule.
And hopefully other reporters will not just think, well, the Times did it and it's done, but report out the story and its various adumbrations.
Absolutely, because these are horror stories that are happening everywhere in the country. So any local reporter can easily find them in their local area. So I do hope that people continue to pay attention to it.
We've been speaking with Joanne Doroshow of the Center for Justice and Democracy. You can find them online at centerjd.org. Joanne Doroshow, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.